Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
In his first stint as International Relations and Cooperation Minister, Ronald Lamola stressed the need for government to intensify efforts to help South African companies and state-owned enterprises engage in meaningful opportunities in Africa to stimulate economic growth. And at a South African Institute of International Affairs symposium last week, he said the government was looking to strengthen its partnerships in Africa to address business challenges and create a favorable environment for conducting business. He pointed out that South Africa had maintained its strong position as an investor in Africa over the past year, and that with over 450 projects in various countries, and noted that this achievement was the result of a coordinated approach and investment initiatives, and commended the efforts of the Development Bank of Southern Africa, and the Industrial Development Corporation. He said that the government would continue to work closely with its neighbors in Southern Africa to expand and strengthen collaboration in oil and gas, green hydrogen, and water resources, as well as improving movement of goods and services, and that he wanted to bolster the economies and improve the livelihoods of our people while contributing towards the full attainment of the regional integration agenda. Now, what I'm aware of Ronald Lamola is certainly as Justice Minister, he's knew not a great deal of history and certainly not a lot about international affairs. And I was curious to wonder whether he had the right idea about trade into and with the rest of Africa. But I thought the best way to deal with it is to ask a returning guest, Mr. Donald Mackay, to give us the benefit of his wisdom in this field, and probably no one better to do so. Donald, welcome, and welcome back to Chai FM.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, so I think the strategic idea of the minister is a good one. I think trade with Africa is important, but at the same time, we've done an awful lot to harm our relationships on the continent, and so that is an important goal, but it might be quite a difficult goal to attain unless we walk back some of the more harmful policies. So as an example, a number of our master plans, which were put in place predominantly, but not exclusively by Minister Patel, have taken a direct attack on other African states. So we see this most obviously with the clothing and textile master plan, which deliberately targets the other customs union members, Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Eswatini. Now, fortunately, it's not been successful, but that doesn't mean that there is not some political price that will be paid for that. And this has, of course, been observed by the rest of the continent. So when we look at the Continental Agreement, for example, the most important country in that agreement is South Africa, the big market that everyone wants to get access to. Oh my God, I apologize, there's a drill. The market that everyone wants access to is the South African market. We've made accessing our market, I think, unreasonably difficult. And so we can't take a kind of imperial view on Africa as a place where we send our products to and we allow nothing in. That relationship is going to have to be rebalanced. And I think it's doable, but it is going to require some effort. I'm not sure if that's helpful, sorry.
I think it's. I know that sort of historically there's been a fair amount of animosity towards the ANC government, the South Africa of the ANC government, because I think a lot of African countries see South Africans as having a sense of entitlement in respect to their relationships with African countries, and perhaps the dominance that South Africa once had in Africa, which has reduced over the last few years, it was not something that was recognized by the South African government. Perhaps there was an element of arrogance on the part of the South African government. So it's tended to deal with other African countries as sort of subordinate partners at the very time when our economy has been sinking and others have in fact been growing. So it seems like I wondered whether that wasn't part of that hubris that the ANC is perhaps not seen, particularly the Southern African development area, as being worthy of or being entitled to be treated with some measure of respect if any headway is going to be made economically in the region.
Yeah, so that's absolutely correct. I'd perhaps go a step further and say we've deliberately, but perhaps not with bad intention, have created a really problematic policy space in the customs union. Mm-hmm. And we've done this by way of something called the revenue sharing formula, which says the give or take 90 billion rand or so per year that we collect in customs duties does not get distributed between the countries according to how much is collected in each state. So South Africa gives up the lion's share of that, but we don't give it up free of charge. What we do is, in turn, these countries allow us to formulate trade policy for the whole region. And so South Africa's trade industrial policy by law effectively becomes theirs. They don't participate to any meaningful degree in that, but in turn we pay them. That's fine when mostly we're acting in the region's interest. That becomes far more problematic when we act against the region's interest purely in our own interest. Now, because these economies are much smaller than ours, they can't really do anything about it, particularly the two very small economies of Lesotho and Eswatini are sort of stuck. Mm-hmm. And so they have to accept it. But that doesn't mean we end up with great policies for the region. Mm. And so the dilemma is when we do what we've just recently gone and done, which you know I would argue is both illegal in terms of the customs union agreement and also just against the spirit of what we're trying to do, we're making it much harder for those economies to do well. Mm. And we, at the same time, seem to struggle with the idea that we have all of these illegal migrants entering South Africa. Now, if you deliberately harm what are already very poor countries, those people who lose their jobs there are not going to be fleeing into Mozambique for better opportunities. So the problem, I think, has tended to be viewed in very simplistic terms. You know, if we can create more jobs in our clothing manufacturing sector, then we're better off, without considering the greater economic consequences of what happens when we do that. And so I think the way we've thought about this, the same with the xenophobic attacks on other Africans, the way we've dealt, I think, in a very ham-fisted way with skilled migrants from the rest of the continent. You know, we have people in my own business who have PhDs who are still struggling to get residence here. I mean, this is outrageous. And I think because of that, we've not endeared ourselves to the rest of the continent. And so Africa is really important to South Africa's future. But we shouldn't expect the rest of Africa to throw their doors open just because we happen to share the same continent with them. You know, if you take a country like Morocco in some ways has more in common with Europe than it does with South Africa. And, you know, so the idea that we share this continent doesn't necessarily mean that there are obvious reasons for us to trade with each other, to offer services to each other. And I think we as South Africa have done less than we could have to use the soft power that we have in Africa productively. So, you know, what we're now going to try to do is try to reconcile the rhetoric of how important Africa is while we treat other African states and their citizens really poorly.
I think probably characterizes the tensions one's seen in South Africa's relationship with the rest of the continent, because it's been very much a case of fine sounding and almost cooperative, and we've got to, in a way, make our way against the larger world. Just looking at that from, you know, when he talks about sort of 450 projects or in Africa, to what extent has the private sector in South Africa, has its impact in Africa been a success? And to what extent has that success rested on government policy, government involvement, or despite government policy and involvement?
We've definitely had some successes. We've also had some abject failures in the form of, for example, Tiger Brands' failed investment in Nigeria. We've had some successes. If you travel through Africa, it's not uncommon to see a Nando's or a Steers or a ShopRite across the continent. So, you know, I don't think it's been an unmitigated failure. Mining companies, we have South African mining businesses elsewhere. But I think the more important question is how much of that is as a result of what government has done. Maybe there's some of it. There probably is a little. But I would think a very small amount of that is connected to government. I think because South Africa is relatively rich compared to the other African countries, should not for a moment be confused with us governing better than many of these countries. So lots of them are starting to figure out that they, you know, what they need to do to have better functioning economies. Kenya's got its issues at the moment, without a doubt. But Kenya has, as a strategy, certainly if not in the short term, figured out that it has to do some things to get its economy working better. And there are versions of that across the continent. I mean, we can justifiably take some umbrage at the behavior of, oh my God, I'm forgetting his name. I apologize. President of Rwanda. It is Kagame. My apologies. We could say he treats his own citizens quite poorly, which he does. We could say, you know, what is M23? You know, is that really just by extension the Rwandan army? But the reality is these countries have seen a lot of development, you know, far greater than you would expect in a landlocked, tiny country like Rwanda. Now, why does Rwanda not look like Lesotho? It really should, but it doesn't. You know, why is that? And so I think South Africa is losing its ability to influence in the way that it once did. Mm. I don't think in many states South Africa has a good relationship with most African states, even within the customs union, despite the fact that a country like Lesotho is almost completely dependent on South Africa, doesn't mean that there's a comfortable relationship. And so I think most of what we see is probably driven by the private sector.
Now, which are the departments that really need to make the difference for there to be a change in both the attitude to other countries and to their attitude to ours from a trading point of view? Because, as you say, the fact that we're on the same continent is often touted as being, you know, it's a historical thing. Our relationships are meant to be unique and looking to something that isn't offered or isn't available in the rest of the world. And we have this potential unity, but we're forgetting about the fact that there are over 50 countries on the continent, all from very different backgrounds, ethnic, religious, et cetera, social, cultural. So there's a lot of walking the, sort of talking the talk, but not really walking the walk, or walking the talk for that matter. Which are where are the areas governmentally that things really need to happen? And it doesn't strike me that international affairs is anything but more of the sort of marketing and diplomatic arm. It's in and of itself is not going to make the difference.
No. So I think I think it should be making more of a difference than it does. And I'm very happy to give Minister Ramamola, oh my God, what is going on with me, Lamola, today? I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt because, you know, I really want him to do well in that role. It's an important role. It is, you know, to some degree, South Africa's advertising agency for lots of things. It's what keeps our relationships with other countries on a steady keel. And I think there's a lot that can be done to improve those relationships. So, you know, I'd like to see the minister spending some time on the rest of the continent. I'd like to see the minister take a stance on the horrors unfolding in Sudan, which you know is the sort of the unspoken genocide that is happening right now and that nobody is talking about. You know, the situation we created, for example, when we had al-Bashir in South Africa and then kind of smuggled him out of the country, you know, we may think that that's a massive diplomatic coup. What it has done is the hundreds of thousands of families that were devastated because of his mass murders certainly don't view South Africa as a friendly force. And, you know, so I think the principles that we apply to other parts of the world, you know, we've got to start at home. So I think the Foreign Affairs Department is important. You know, we gave Mugabe, for example, many chances that he simply should not have been given. We smuggled his wife out the country when she beat that woman up really badly. You know, these sorts of things are not acceptable to my mind. We need to behave like the responsible country we should be. So that would be the one side. Trade and industry is incredibly important. All of our trade agreements, all of those things, they are the custodian of our trading relationships in goods and services with the rest of the continent. And I think that happens in two ways. The one way is we're trying to open new markets for our products or source raw materials cheaper out of these other countries. But it's also about treating our trading partners like adults. So for example, when Mugabe was in power, in breach of the SADC agreement, they would just impose these additional border taxes. And then Minister Davies at the time says, look, it's not right what they're doing, but we're not going to do anything to them because it's Zimbabwe and we're quite fond of Mugabe, actually. And so we're going to let it go. Malawi at the moment is refusing to reduce duties in terms of the agreement. And we kind of go, well, you know, we'll let it slide. And it's problematic because these countries may be poor, but you're not dealing with children. And we shouldn't kind of infantilize the rest of the continent. And that's, you know, much of what we do. So we need to hold them, in my view, to the same standard that we rightly are holding Europeans or anyone else. There's no reason why, because you're in Africa, you should be allowed to behave poorly. And so those are the two departments, I think, which are crucial. I think it's also important that our president spends more time on the continent. You know, the one thing Mbeki did really well was sort of set up this pan-African focus on saying, yeah, how do we get Africa to work together? How do we get good institutions? I think we can set a wonderful example. You know, we've had an election which people can say what they want. Unless you're in MK, everyone else thinks it was a free and fair election. This is not a common occurrence on this continent. And, you know, we've got to start to leverage the soft power, I think, that comes from setting what I think is an amazing example. So, you know, we can criticize the ANC justifiably for many things, but I think how they've handled this has just been superb, and they didn't have to. We need to leverage that goodwill as well.
I think you're right. I think it's a matter of taking the advantage of having been seen very distinctly to accept the result, which was very dramatically not in favor of the ANC, but at the same time improve our relations continent-wide. And to what extent does our role in or as being part of the African Union, does that have to perhaps change or adjust to make those, I suppose, more adult, more mature relationships between us and other African countries actually work from an economic point of view?
Yeah, I do think so. I think we must realize we're in many ways, you know, we're a wealthy country in Africa, but when you compare us to the rest of the world, we really are just another African country. You know, if Africa is going to do well, and I think it's important that Africa does well, it's important that we treat African states as adults, you know, and we don't. So I think the African Union has a role to play. I think when elections are rigged in Africa, which is not an uncommon occurrence, South Africa cannot cover for the scoundrels that steal elections. And we've set an example. I mean, I think a wonderful example that we can all be very proud of. And we need to use that voice to say, we're not okay with people rigging elections. That's not fine. We're not okay with the people of Sudan being slaughtered in the way that they are in a brutal civil war. And I think we still retain some of the magic that we had from Mandela, where people will listen to us on these kinds of things. You know, they may not agree with us on lots of our economics, but we still have this ability where there's conflict, I think, for you know, people to pay attention. And now we've come through what should have been a civil war in South Africa in the 90s and didn't. We've come through the first election where the party has lost majority and didn't for a moment suggest anything other than that they would step back from that role. And I think that kind of leverage is powerful. The African Union, you know, I think we did a lot of harm there as well in the time that NDZ was sitting there. But that doesn't, you know, that is what it is. I don't think that has to be a legacy that lives on forever. So, I'd agree. But we should, you know, we should perhaps recognize that the challenges in Africa are not just about political philosophies. We have incredible violence on this continent, particularly against women. You know, these are things that I think South Africa can stand up. You know, we can, again, it is not acceptable that Uganda passes legislation criminalizing homosexuality. And these are things we should be speaking up about. I don't think we should be shy about our stance on these things. And I think in some cases, our voices have been more muted than they should be.
Just a question. South Africa and its sort of seemingly prominent role in BRICS. Yes. How's that generally viewed in Africa? Because, you know, all the new members to BRICS have largely been authoritarian states from the Middle East or the East. One hasn't seen what I assume some African states would have liked to have seen, which is much more consideration of some new African members of BRICS. What's your sense of that dynamic?
Yeah, well, I think, BRICS is just a very weird phenomenon to me because unless you view it through the lens of an expansion of Chinese foreign policy, the BRICS doesn't really make any sense. The countries hardly trade with each other. There's not a lot of huge investment between them. Not too long ago, people were beating each other up on the mountains between India and China with sticks and cricket bats, you might recall. So there's not a logical reason for BRICS to exist as an economic bloc or as a trading bloc. If on the other hand, you say that what China's been doing is putting together a group of countries with an anti-West sentiment, then I think BRICS works pretty well, actually. Mm. My concerns with BRICS are multiple. I think for the longest time, I thought BRICS was mostly harmless. It didn't do anything. Nobody cared too much what happened in BRICS because BRICS didn't do anything. And so it was fine. I think what started happening is the cost of being in BRICS has to be calculated. So I'm not suggesting South Africa shouldn't be there, but we shouldn't think it's a free ride to be there. We're keeping company with some of the most odious states in the world at the moment. And we're not even pretending to hold our nose. So I think this is, you know, a problem. I mean, it's not really disputed that Iran is a state sponsor of terror. Right. Russia is attempting to colonize its neighbor at the moment. It's, China is threatening to invade Taiwan before the century passes of the of Mao taking over and the CCP coming into power. So this is a particularly belligerent group. I mean, India itself has its own issues with how it's been treating its own Muslim population. So, you know, Ethiopia is, again, hardly a bastion of freedom and democracy. So I think from that perspective, we do need to be somewhat cautious on what the cost of that relationship is when we look at the important partners, trading partners and investment partners we have in the form of the US, in the form of Europe particularly. What is the cost of that relationship? Just to give you a number quickly, Sarah, if we remove India and China from BRICS for a moment, we say, how much do we export to the rest of BRICS? We export more to Zimbabwe in a year than all of the other BRICS countries combined, the expanded BRICS, that is. We export more to Eswatini than we do to Russia. And so the cost of membership becomes high when countries are invading other countries and you're standing silent on those invasions. And I think, so from that perspective, I think we've got to start tallying up what that cost is.
And I presume it's aggravated by the fact that we appear to have been careless with our Western economic partners, the countries that we actually do export significant amounts to compared to what you've described. Just to get finally your view on the fact that Home Affairs is now a DA ministry or DM has a DA minister, who certainly out of the starting blocks made the right noises about extending visas, probably as much for pragmatic reasons as to make a semi-policy point. From a business point of view, in both with Africa and probably just about anywhere else, but particularly with Africa, what do you think of the quick gains that can be made by the ministry under its new regime, if it has the power to do so? And although I clearly imagine that policy-wise, it wants to make things better, quicker, faster, and friendlier from an investment point of view. But what do you think of the sort of fairly immediate things it can do that can make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no longer sure. I don't have kids, so I'm not quite in touch with what the what do they call that thing, the unabridged birth certificate issue was with visas when people come and visit. But I have friends of mine who, you know, over the years have tried to come to South Africa with somewhat disturbing processes to go through just so they can come and spend their pounds in South Africa. And likewise of even South African people trying to leave South Africa. You know, it's a divorced couple. The woman takes her kids. She doesn't want to speak to the husband or ex-husband, can't get, you know. So these sorts of things, I think, have to be expedited and addressed. Tourism, I think, presents some of the largest opportunities of all sectors in South Africa with the least amount of money having to be spent from government. So you just need to stop doing silly things. And, you know, so I think that's the one side. I think the critical skills issues have to be addressed just incredibly urgently. I even go so far as to say if experts have to be brought in, if people have to be brought in on a temporary basis to help clear the backlog, this cannot be allowed to go on like this. It's just a massive deterrent to investment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, people look at this and say, oh my God, it's just another person that's going to be driving an Uber or, you know, waitering in a restaurant. But we forget the same problems beset foreign investors who can't get their managing directors into the country. So the ability to create employment when we lack the critical skills in South Africa and we won't let it in, strikes me as just incredibly harmful. So, you know, I think if I could recommend anything to Minister Schreiber, it would be to expedite the process of getting people into the country or as many countries as possible without a visa. I mean, I understand visas are crucial in some cases, but we have visa requirements on countries that really don't need to have visas. So get rid of those as quickly as possible. And then on the other hand, find a way to expedite the problem of the critical skills visas particularly. But also we can't, you know, strategically you can't have these aggressive anti-foreigner policies while you have a porous border. So we've got to, you know, the other side of all of this, and I'm, you know, very much in favor of allowing people to move around as much as possible. But you can't have a situation like we have now where there's effectively no ability to police your borders. And what you then do is when the people are in the country, you kind of punish them for your own inefficiency. I think that's problematic.
So, Donald, thank you very much. It's about largely about common sense, but from the sound of things, and applying it. And thank you for giving us some insights into those relationships.
You're welcome, Sarah.